Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 12. I really hope it's 12 because I'm saying it's 12. And I am joined today by Freddie Govita.
Hello.
So Dan's in a cafe right now. We've just tried to call with him and it was horrible. There's no other words for it. There's two other people in his cafe right now, a baby and somebody washing up china as loudly as possible.
It was not pleasant.
No, it wasn't.
No.
But it's not his fault, bless him.
No.
He must have gone to one of those cafes where they still serve you with china mugs, like proper mugs.
Yeah, or well, they just hate, you know, their plates, and they were just like smashing them when they finish using them.
That could also be a thing. I can imagine that that cafe is closing.
Yeah, they've run out of plates.
Yeah. But it's no nice food. When you get a proper cup. That feels really good.
You're right, you know. You're absolutely right.
Central London now, there's no chance of getting a mug.
No, like, you get a glass sometimes, don't you, with the coffee in it?
Yeah, that would still be good. I stole a glass from the Vortex a couple of years ago. I know, and I felt so proud of myself, and I was really pleased with it. And then when I sort of realised that it's like a volunteer-led organisation, more and more it started to gnaw away at me until I realised that I'd done something truly awful. And so I snuck it back in, gave it back.
Excellent.
I've never told anyone that before.
I'm so proud of you.
Thanks, man. Of all the places to steal a glass from, the Vortex is not the right choice.
No. Does this feel cathartic for you? Do you feel much better now?
Yeah. I've been wanting to get this off my chest since I stole it in 2010.
Oh, Rob.
I know.
Disgraceful.
So in the news this week, Mark Lockhart's playing at the 606 on the 25th of April, which is sometime next week. I could probably be more specific if I just had a cursory glance at my calendar. The 20 Tuesday evening. He's playing with Nicky Isles, James Madron, and Steve Watts. Now, Freddie, as a keen young jazz musician, what do you make of Mark's choice of band?
I think it's excellent. Mm-hmm. I know that James and Steve, and Nicky, I think they play as a rhythm section with Mark and, who's the guitar player in the, I can't remember the name of the band. I'm going to start with something really stupid. The band with Norma Winston, they have a band. Clockmakers? No?
With Mike Walker as well.
Mike Walker, that's it. Yeah, that band is amazing. And so they, you know, they've got a great relationship, all the musicians already. So I guess Mark will slot in rather nicely with those guys, I should imagine. I'd quite like to go to that, actually. That sounds great.
Is that ever a thing when you book a band that you have you ever thought about people who already are playing together to be like, that would be sick?
Yeah, definitely. And other things where you sometimes sort of notice characteristics in people's playing that are like people that you like on records, and you kind of stick them together because you think that they have similar qualities to partnerships that you've heard on albums that seem to work really well. So that's always quite fun. But yeah, definitely, you want like you want that hookup between members of the band to be good. And if you know that those guys or girls play together lots, then that's always a good thing.
It is. It's a team sport.
Definitely. You know. And sport is the key word here.
It's a bit like badminton. It's just jazz. I worry that it's an awful spectator sport, but it's a lot of fun to be involved in.
I don't know.
Well, your show was your fun. Show sold out last night?
My show sold out. Just quite amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. I don't know. I don't think we mentioned it. You had your album launch last night.
Yeah.
Upstairs at Ronnie's.
Yes.
Ronnie Scott's, to be.
Yes.
Give it its full professional title. How was the gig?
The music went fantastically well. I felt probably like it's one of the best gigs we've done as a band, I think.
Yeah.
The atmosphere in the room was amazing. Nothing quite like playing to a sort of a crowd of people that actually sort of have chosen to come and watch you play. I don't know if that's but I do a lot of gigs at places where, you know, it's there's maybe like a regular crowd that go to the same gig every week because it's their local gig, and they'll probably come and see you, you hope, and what you do might not be to everybody's tastes.
Yeah.
But in this situation, because it was the launch, I think there was just a lot of very positive feeling in the room, and I think everybody wanted us to do well, and so I feel like hopefully we responded to that, and so we just had a lovely evening full of warmth and happiness, and it was I had a great time.
Oh, beautiful. So today's Phil Meadows show. So Phil lives in southeast London. I forget where, but I've decided you can judge for yourselves when you listen to this episode. It sounds like a profoundly dangerous place because there's so many emergency services issues during the show. And Phil's house actually burnt down last year, or his neighbours next door to him burnt down. And then the fire service, when they put the fire out, they flooded his bedroom and like destroyed all of his instruments.
No.
Yeah. So I went into a sax shop a few months ago and Phil was in there like buying and servicing new everything, absolutely everything he owned.
Oh, man.
I know.
That's dreadful.
I know. And now,
can you imagine?
Well, Phil's a, as you're about to find out, like a doubling woodwind saxophone player. So he's got a lot of stuff to replace. It's really annoying, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And listening to this show, you get the impression that the situation hasn't really improved.
Oh, dear. Poor Philip.
I know. So, poor Philip. Philip Meadows. I might retitle his show with his full name.
Yeah.
Well, here he comes. Phil Meadows. So, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Bolton.
Mm.
Yeah, the classiest of towns. I spent the first kind of 16 years of my life living up in the north with my family, being a huge Bolton Wanderers supporter and generally being a bit of a northern monkey.
Do you still go to away games?
Whenever they're in London, I'm there. I went to the FA Cup second round replay against Crystal Palace. Palace,
right.
Where we got beaten by a £30 million striker.
Oh, that's devastating. When I think of Bolton, I think of two things. Peter Kay and JJ Okocha.
Oh, yeah. The two finest things.
I bet that's something that you get really sick of hearing after a while.
Yeah, well, we've got other comedians. They're just not as good.
I love Peter Kay. He's absolutely outstanding.
Yeah. Also, the guy who does that program, Take Me Out, Paddy McGuinness.
Oh, yeah. He was in Phoenix Nights, wasn't he? That sitcom that Peter Kay made.
Yeah, and the other one as well, Max and Paddy.
Oh, cool.
And we've also got, who else have we got? We've got, Dave Spikey's Wigan. And Vernon Kay, the other Kay, is Bolton as well.
Yes, Vernon Kay. It's good. There's something about the accent that's naturally very funny, I think, in the right hands, you know? So what's... wait, let me try that again. Do you remember your first, like, musical experiences?
Great use of the word yeah, I think my first, well, I remember certain things about primary school and playing the recorder in group recorder clubs and things like that. I remember my year four primary school teacher nipping people in the back of the neck if they made a mistake.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. It's, that's the American, you know, if well, whiplash is nothing on Mrs. Lloyd. You know.
Wow, man, that's pretty weird.
It's pretty hardcore, isn't it? I think
corporal
if that was
punishment
done now,
for squeaks.
Yeah, she wouldn't be there if it was done now.
No.
And I remember playing the EastEnders theme tune in my first saxophone performance in year six at primary school and messing it all up. And I've not stopped messing up gigs since.
His whole career has just been trying to make amends.
Yeah, I still can't play it.
So you started on like whole class recorder, like a music service thing?
Yeah, or like it was inbuilt in the school, but it was kind of like everybody had a recorder and the recorder choir played in assemblies for some strange reason. And the school offered different like pathways into music, so you could learn, I think you could learn flute or clarinet in 1 year or violin or guitar in another.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to play the saxophone, so I didn't do any of those, but you know, there was some provision on offer, which is cool.
Yeah. When did you get your first sax then?
I got my first sax.
Or even like, when? How did you know that that was the one that you wanted to play?
Well, mainly because of an episode of The Simpsons. I was sat around at home and there's an episode where Lisa's playing this duet. And
yeah, with Bleeding Gums Murphy.
Bleeding Gums Murphy's just died.
Yeah.
He's now in the clouds and she's like sat on the end of a bridge, like that Sonny Rollins kind of thing. And Darth Vader comes and says hello.
Oh, I know the one. And Mufasa's there as well.
Oh, yeah. All the classics.
It's all James Earl Jones parts, isn't it? And then this is CNN guy shows up. I remember exactly the bit.
And then they play a duet from The Bridge to the Clouds.
Yeah.
And I, for some reason, I just turned around to my parents and I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do.
Wow.
And then we took that to the school and the school turned around and said, there's no chance.
What, you took the episode and was like, "This, look, watch this."
Yeah, that was it. You know, the whole school watching 20 minutes of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
No, just the idea of playing the saxophone, and they said, you know, you can play clarinet or you can play flute, but you can't play the saxophone. But that was what I wanted to do, and I had to beg my parents for many, many months before they would let me get one. But I also, when that happened, me and my dad started lessons together.
Oh, cool.
So it was kind of like a nice thing. It was like, if we're going to get a saxophone, my dad wanted to learn how to play it too.
Which is he really still nice. Learning?
Yeah, he's still playing. He set up a community jazz band in Bury that he used to play with a lot, and he now is a very proud member of the Nantwich Concert Band in Cheshire.
Wow, that's awesome. And you guys go to jazz festivals together?
Yeah, we have an annual tradition. We fly out to Holland and we go to North Sea Jazz Festival in Rotterdam every year as like our father-son time.
Oh man, that's cool.
Yeah, which is really nice and, you know, comes down to a lot of the gigs and stuff, which is great.
Yeah, that's really nice. I'm sure he's got lots of family fun suggestions for you still about how to play and what to do. And I didn't like that tune so much, but that one was, if that's anything like my mum anyway.
No, he's a bit more supportive than your mum by the sounds of it.
Oh man, she's going to be well.
Rob's mum, you've got to sort that out. every now and then, you know, we play some music together and stuff. And I remember he learnt a bit of drums for a while. And, you know, I got him when I was living in Manchester, I got him in a few of the house bands when I was asked to do those by the legendary Ed Kenyak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've played some music together along the way too.
That's awesome. So then you went to Chet's when you were like 16 or 15? or 16 or something.
Yeah, I think I went into sixth form the year after you left.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go before that because you were still there.
Of course.
This is going to come out horrible, isn't it?
I always like to think that they were searching for my replacement.
I always think that I only got the place because, like, it was the same year as Sam Healy, and he left.
Oh, that's right. He left a few years early.
Yeah, so you went to the Northern and Sam went to Purcell. And then they had a desperate need for someone who played some jazz alto. And I was probably the only person who auditioned.
Well, I'm sure that's not true. But I do think there's probably a lot to be said for being in the right place at the right time.
So I went to Cheatham's just for a couple of years for sixth form. I had a great time. Felt slightly imprisoned at times, but, yeah. You know, learn a lot about music along the way as well.
Yeah.
With lots of thanks to Ian Dixon.
Yes.
His knowledge of
everything.
He's
the Yoda of our podcast.
Oh, yeah. He's a man that is everywhere but nowhere.
Yeah, because he's on every episode in some way or another without ever making a personal appearance.
I think it would be, it would be f***ing mega if he came on and did one.
Yeah, Ian, I have a feeling I'm going to have to do it. I'm just going to go to his house uninvited and be like, hey, what are you doing? And then either record in secret or just be like, oh, we're doing the jazz podcast.
I think it would be brilliant either way.
Yeah, I can't lose. I can't miss.
Yeah.
So you enjoyed Chets?
Yeah, Cheatham's was cool. It was very different because, you know, I was from Bolton.
Yes.
And Cheatham's is an international school and, you know, it's full of people from all kinds of backgrounds, from the very rich to the very poor.
I don't know if they still do this, but when I was there, you could go as like an income assessed student. So if you were talented but unable to afford it, that was never a stumbling block.
Yeah, it was all on a sliding scale. So I think it was the most expensive school in Europe to go to. But not if your parents weren't multimillionaires.
Yeah, that sounds ideal.
Yeah, which is great, because I remember having someone in my year whose family owned Samsung or something.
I used to enjoy that. Googling the fees and then figuring out if anyone was paying full beans.
Yeah, who was and who wasn't? I certainly wasn't.
No. So what inspired you to audition there? You know, because that's kind of the beginning of the rest of your life, I guess. Like once you've, you know, that point where you start formally studying music and then you realize like that you want to be a musician and that it's already happening.
Yeah, I think I wanted to audition because I knew it was what I wanted to do from an early age, but my parents were super supportive and are super supportive, but they didn't really have the expertise in music because they both spent their life working for the NHS. And I'd had a saxophone teacher who got me to like grade five and then said he couldn't take me any further. And then I got another saxophone teacher, who took me kind of the next bit along the way, but we were looking for a really like good saxophone teacher who could teach kind of post grade eight and teach some jazz and different things. And I ended up having lessons with a great bebop saxophone player called Munch Manship.
Yeah.
And even at that point, it was just clear that I wanted to do more and more and more of the music thing. And my parents were trying to find out how I could do it. It was the age old story of, you know, being in the local big band and being a very young lead alto player and not feeling particularly challenged by school music and stuff like that. Munch was great, but it was my parents doing some research to find out where I could get more. And then somebody mentioned the idea of Cheetham's, and it kind of became a no-brainer because of the faculty they had there and because of the opportunities that they can create and, you know, and their track record. And yeah, so it was, I kind of auditioned because it seemed, once you know a place like that exists, it seems just so logical.
Yeah. I like that. Okay. A very Spock-like answer. It was logical.
But for more about that, you can talk to Kit.
Yeah, switch over now if you haven't listened to Kit. Go to the middle, do the Star Trek and come back.
Yeah.
So at what point, do you remember when you made a conscious decision that it was that you were going to be a jazz musician?
Yeah, I had a few battles when I was at Cheetham's, and it wasn't, I mean, these aren't any bad battles to have, but I was offered a place there as a jazz saxophonist.
That must have been pretty new, because that certainly wasn't something I was ever aware that was like a, well, basically, you know, Ian Dixon teaching jazz there happened in my very last year.
Yeah.
So I guess you were pioneering a kind of a new breed of student at that point.
Yeah, well, it was so new that they didn't really want it to happen at that time. So I got offered a place as a jazz saxophonist with a view of having Ian as my, like, primary teacher.
Yeah.
And then when I got there, I had classical lessons as a primary and no jazz lessons on my timetable, despite them offering me a place as a jazz musician.
Yes.
And the school, and, you know, rightly so, because it's a school that's been steeped in kind of world-class classical tradition for so many years, and they were just kind of finding their footing in jazz at that time.
Yeah.
They turned around and went, you need to do the classical thing, because that's what they know. And, you know, they didn't know about this burgeoning jazz scene that seems to be happening at the moment. And yeah, they kind of pushed and pushed for the classical. And I pushed and pushed for the jazz. And it got to a point where they run these concerto competitions. And the school got, you know, different people sign up to play a concerto. And I remember signing up to play one. I think it was the Ronald Binge, the classic Ronald Binge concert.
Yes, yes.
And I didn't learn it. And I turned up to the audition. And the director of music and the head of woodwind was there. And the guest, which was Rob Buckland.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was quite a big deal for the school. And I turned up and they asked for the photocopy of the music and I didn't have it.
Oh, man.
And then they said, well, can we have your copy of the music? Because you're supposed to have memorized it. And I hadn't memorized it. I hadn't even learned it. So I sight read a concerto in front of them and then got called to one side at the end of the day, you know, to say how embarrassing that was for the school.
Yeah.
And I argued about, well, I was never supposed to be doing this. I was supposed to be a jazz student. And then the next week I got Ian Dixon as my primary teacher.
Wow.
So I really had to fight for it. And that, as I say, it's no fault of the school. It was just such a transitional time for them, because I know they've got a really flourishing jazz department now that's grown.
Yeah.
There seems to be some kind of like heavy duty.
I was just going to say, sounds like you live in a really dangerous area.
This is another one. I think Forest Hill is kicking off.
Oh, wow.
I mean, houses, if you want to buy one, cost like £700,000 now.
Yeah.
But then this is like, what is it? Let's have a look. It's like everything. It's been like fire.
I've never seen all three in convoy.
They just keep coming. I can't see or smell anything, but wow. You know, this could be the last thing that I ever do. So if it is, then
what a legacy, mum and dad. What a legacy to leave. I want that on the news. Phil died whilst recording an episode of the Jazz Podcast. And then
doubled your hits.
Exactly. I like that. Not that we go viral or anything, just doubled. Just like a medium increase in listeners as a result.
Well, but, it's jazz music. We can be ambitious.
So I assume then that once you found those lessons with Ian, that was it for you and the hopes of playing anything other than jazz.
Yeah, it was. And I think that continued.
I guess that was already the case, like you were saying.
Yeah, it was already the case. It was all I wanted to do, but it is hard to get that real expert kind of knowledge. And I knew at Cheatham's they had it because Ian Dixon's great jazz trumpeter, Richard Isles, who I was fortunate to have a bit younger at Bolton Youth Jazz Orchestra as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Berry, who's an absolute, you know, loose tubes legend. And Dave Walsh was there when I was. I think it would have been Dave Hassel a bit earlier. And it was just like such a great jazz faculty. And Les Chisnell for piano lessons. It was like, you know, there was nothing like that in the Northwest.
Yeah.
And it was all happening in that place, but the school didn't quite know how to handle it. And I think, you know, I remember when I came to applying to music colleges, I remember, you know, even my parents echoing the thing of, you know, if you want to make a living out of music, you need to be able to play both jazz and classical music. And I was thinking, well, the saxophone's only been invented for the past 150 years, so I know where the repertoire lies.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I also remember thinking things like, you know, Rob Buckland is so good at that thing, and that's why he can, you know, play all over the world doing it. But I don't really see anyone coming through doing that, but you see people coming through playing jazz music.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you make, which is very hard to disagree with. I think with, like, not that this is called the Contemporary Classical Podcast or anything, but it seems like for that genre, there's like one person every 10 years. You know, that could, like Carl Raven, for instance, who came through as a student at the RNCM and now teaches there. I don't know when Carl graduated, but probably slightly more than 10 years ago. But anyway,
I think he's got a legendary past in my Cheatham's experience.
Has he? Tell us about it.
Oh, well, no, just a song.
Let's bring him down.
Oh, no, he's great. I've never met him. But I remember after the after the prom or something, being sat in a room with Ben Watt and, you know, being completely sober and recording a song. He had Ben had this postcard on his wall. Oh, this is going to be embarrassing for him, but let's do it. And he had this postcard on his wall of the Eclipse Saxophone Quartet.
Yeah.
And I was asking him who they were, and he was like, oh, that's Carl Raven. So he just started singing this song, and he grabbed the guitar, and it ended up on YouTube. And then, I mean, it's completely embarrassing. But then Ben went on to the RNCM and had Carl Raven as his teacher.
Fantastic.
In his first lesson, and Carl had seen the video.
I can imagine Carl was just terrified by this revelation.
I think he was, but I've heard on the grapevine that he may or may not have secretly enjoyed it. There was no offense meant by any of it. Of course. I've still not met him to this day, and I'm terrified for the moment that I do.
I like it when you meet someone for the first time and you immediately have some explaining to do.
From 10 years ago now.
Yeah, it's great. Every day this goes on, it's getting a little more awkward.
And it's even more awkward because, like, Ben, we kind of need to take that video down now because it was... but it's on an old YouTube account and I can't remember the login details.
Oh, brutal. It's slowly so just it's, destroying his career.
It's there.
Yeah.
It's destroying all three of our careers.
Wow. Well, maybe we can make it a thing again and find the link and... Oh, man. So after school, you went to Leeds College of Music.
Yeah, so, yeah, I did all the kind of, like, standard, you know, music college auditions. But I just loved the vibe at Leeds. It was friendly, it was welcoming. You know, it just seemed like a really nice place to spend a few years and try and get better. And yeah, I absolutely loved my 3 years there. Not that I didn't love my years at Cheatham's. You know, I enjoyed it all, but, you know, Leeds has particularly fond memories.
Yeah. Who were you taught by then when you were there?
So I was taught for the first couple of years by a guy called Joel Purnell, who people may or may not know, but he is an absolute monster of the saxophone. So if you haven't heard him, Google him and check him out.
I like to do this, Phil, where we like give people something better to do than listen to this. That's what I'm like. Stop the show and go and listen to him. That sounds better.
Yeah, but listen to him in a new tab so you can come back to the show.
Make sure to right click, open in new tab.
We'll even leave, like, you know, if you want to listen to the first track on his album, we'll leave, like, you know, 7 minutes and 41 seconds of silence once we do it. And it will come back in as soon as it's finished. So
that sounds incredible. What an interactive way to run this thing.
So press play now.
Yeah. It's synchronizing watches.
Yeah. But Joel is, you know, Joel's absolutely phenomenal, kind of like post-bop. Really into Jerry Bergonzi and that way of thinking, that big American sound, really into Brecker. And just one of the greatest players I've heard in this country that I don't think lots of people have necessarily heard outside of the North.
Yeah.
I think he's incredible. And I was really lucky to have him, and I had him for the first couple of years and then mixed it up in my last year with a combination of another great saxophone player called Simon Kaler, who, again, another monster Bergonzi-influenced player, slightly more contemporary, was involved with LIMA, so the Leeds Improvised Music Association and that kind of thing. And also I had those lessons, but I had lessons with Tori Freestone.
Yeah,
as well, who has been releasing lots of great music recently. So my third year, I kind of went slightly more contemporary on what I had been doing and explored some different things. But yeah, I had loads of great compositional teachers as well when I was there as well. So Jamil Sharif, who's now the head of the course, he taught me a lot about writing music and voicing chords. And then Mark Donlan, who now lives in New Zealand, but, you know, what he taught me, I've never forgotten. And he took me through my final year composition portfolio and got me starting to write for large ensembles, you know, and without Mark, I wouldn't have done that at all. And now it's something I do a lot of, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's basically 50% of being a jazz musician, if you want to have your own band and your own project. You've got to be as competent a writer as you are a player.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, people who are playing more in the tradition sometimes get a tough break at the moment, because everyone seems to be always looking for something new.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you are wanting to share your own voice through your own music, you've got to have some knowledge in the way in which you approach it, because if you don't necessarily know how to write a chart out, or you know, well, you don't even have to write a chart out, if you find it hard to transfer your ideas from your head to other people,
yeah,
even it's hard to kind of run a band that makes the music that sounds how you imagine it to be.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think having those skills in terms of composition is kind of becoming more and more essential as the music develops.
Yeah, even when I was at college, I remember having a 2-hour class with Pete Churchill once, on which we spent the first 30 minutes talking about how important the thickness of the paper is, And like, he was like, if you want people to take your music seriously, print it on proper paper so it feels like a substantial chart.
Yeah, 120 gram.
Yeah, exactly. And then about like taping parts and presentation and literally sitting down with loads of charts and with a roll of sellotape each and just working through it and figuring out, like you say, even once you've figured out how to get your ideas down, you've got to present it well. You've got to make it look good. There's a weirdly psychological element to it, if you want it there to be, which I do quite enjoy.
Yeah, it's the same as anything, isn't it? You know, if you were being taken to court for something, would you go for the lawyer who's wearing the smart suit with his top button done up and a nice knot in his tie, or would you go for the lawyer who's wearing
the Lionel
got a coffee stain, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, the Lionel Hutz or the Saul Goodman.
I like that. There's a great Simpsons where Marge is in court for shoplifting, and Apu's having his memory tested, and Hutz is stood in front of him with a tie on, and he's trying to test his memory, and he's going, "What tie am I wearing today?" And Apu starts going, "You are wearing a checked striped, you know, half winter," and Hutz just turns around and takes it off in front of him, turns back around and goes, "Would it shock you to know that I'm not wearing a tie at all?" Everybody gasps.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just one of those things, though, isn't it? Like, unfortunately, the world we live in is now based on... we live in such a meritocracy. I can't even pronounce that word.
What is it, like a meritocracy?
Yeah, it's like, everything, meritocracy, everything is based, I don't know, it's actually not necessarily based on merit, is it? It's a lot of things now are based on image, and I think if you turn up to a rehearsal and the charts are on nice paper and the copying's good and they're stuck together and everything's set up when you get there, it just feels more inviting, same as... You know, it's almost like creating... When you get to the rehearsal room, it's like the Facebook feed of your process, isn't it? It's the fact that, you know, you log on to Facebook and you see that people are posting about their sunny holiday in Thailand, but they're not posting about anything real.
Yeah.
You know, they're posting their highlights, and the rehearsal is almost like the highlight, isn't it, of everything that you've done.
Yeah, true.
I guess that was a very long-winded way of saying that.
No, I enjoyed it. So let's go after Leeds. Had you always planned to move to London?
Not really. I hate London. I still hate London.
Too many fire engines.
Yeah. Well, now I don't have a house, and this is actually the ghost of Phil Meadows speaking.
Yeah.
No, I've never really been a fan of London. I find it particularly tricky to be creative in a place that has so much conflicting energy all of the time in a relentless kind of way. And I got to the end of my undergrad degree in Leeds, and I was running some jazz nights up there. I ran a night there called the Tuesday Chill Out for about 2 years, and I was doing a bit of touring with a Rat Pack show. And I think it was, you know, that experience of being a final year student and looking to the left and right of me on stage on a professional gig and seeing my teachers that made me think about moving away from Leeds. And not because of the standard of the musicianship, because I was by far the worst musician on the stage, but because... It was that thought of, you know, in 20 years' time, I could still be on this same stage, and, you know, what opportunities are there up here? And I guess I kind of took the coward's way out, which is what everybody seems to do, and move to the place where there's loads of opportunities already. Maybe I should have stayed up there and just tried to create some. But, you know, it was that thing of seeing... I guess seeing the people that I've idolized for 3 years, but then seeing that they're actually now doing the same work that I was doing.
Yeah.
To some degree, you know. They're obviously doing much better shows than that as well.
Yeah.
So at that point, I put in some applications for some postgrad degrees. And I thought, you know, I'll spend another year honing my craft and get to know a new place. I didn't really know too many people down here and just moved on down to London.
Yeah.
And went to Trinity Laban for a year, which was great.
Amazing. You enjoyed that?
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, it's such an amazing building, that Naval College on the river.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Simon Purcell, who runs a course there, is one of the kind of like, well, he's the godfather of British jazz education, essentially. So it was great to go there and learn his way of thinking and have classes with him and with Liam Noble and lessons off Julian Siegel and Martin Speak. And, you know, just an amazing experience to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when you graduated, what was life like when you were just like spat out into London? Did you ever get another job other than teaching or something musical just to make ends meet?
Yeah, well, I did and I didn't. So more so in Leeds, when I was studying, I worked about 6 jobs at once and did my degree.
Yeah.
But like little jobs. So I was a steward in a concert venue and I was a promoter for a venue running jazz events, and I had a couple of students, so I was teaching a bit and all that kind of thing. And I remember I did do a summer of working in the kitchens at Leeds General Infirmary at the hospital.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, gave me a realization of, you know, what hard graft really is.
Well, that's interesting, because I worked in a hospital as well for a couple of years, but I've never known any other musicians who have done the same thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I mainly cleaned kitchens.
Yeah.
I was supposed to be on the front of house, but I didn't think the kitchens were particularly clean enough to be serving patients' food.
Yeah.
So I just walked in and kind of decided that I was going to spend the time cleaning things rather than selling things.
Oh, well.
And I lasted kind of a summer.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just kind of couldn't really do it anymore.
Yeah.
Not because it was a bad job, but just because I morally I couldn't bring myself to be working in a place that's supposed to be helping people get better.
Yeah.
But isn't making all the effort,
right,
to keep the food preparation clean.
Yeah.
And diets healthy. And, you know, there was a lot of lethargy in the catering department there. And I kind of had a moral thing with it.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't work in a place where that was happening.
Yeah, because I always found that, like, doing something while studying music that wasn't music was a really good way of keeping your head screwed on and keeping your perspective straight, you know?
Yeah, well, music is, I mean, it's such a privilege to do, to study, to learn, and it's something that you're so passionate about.
Yeah.
I mean, when we're students, we're all, in this country in particular, we're all pretty ungrateful for the opportunity to learn and study, and we all go to university quite young.
Yeah.
And quite naive. And, you know, the fact that working in the same kitchen as me was a woman only a few years older than me who's got a couple of kids, one that's got, you know, a heavy autism, and she's the only one bringing home the money at £7 an hour.
Yeah.
That's very different to, you know, walking into an institution that on the whole is full of fairly middle-class white British men.
Yeah.
All talking about, you know, which substitution sounds better and which, you know, lick is the coolest and trying to downtrodden really great musician, you know, it's just a very different situation. So I enjoyed it from that perspective, you know, from kind of keeping in touch with normality.
Yeah, definitely. Music's such an all-consuming thing to do. It's easy to kind of lose your mind if you're not careful, you know, at music college.
It's also such an insular thing to do.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, you spend hours and hours on your own in a small room with a mirror and a music stand
yeah.
and a piano.
Yeah.
You know, it's not particularly, although it's social when you get to the stage, it's not necessarily the most social thing to develop the skills.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So, well, yeah, what was going on then when you finished Trinity and you're now just free and then you're in London and you're sort of floating around?
When I was at Trinity, I kind of looked for some work in view of leaving.
Yeah.
I had managed to get myself like a little bit of teaching and with like Greenwich Music Hub and Lewisham Music Hub and a school. So I could cover my bills. And I'd also, whilst at Trinity, started going down to the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, and I'd kind of like earned a chair.
Yeah.
So I became the lead alto with Nigel for a couple of years, and that was at that time, and you know, that also helped cover a bit of rent because it's a professional development scheme, so they give you a contribution for the time that you put in with them. So when you do a gig, you get paid some money. So it was, you know, there was a few things happening, and I'd put my own band to, well, I, yeah, I'd put a new band together. I had a band up in Manchester, but then I put a band together down in London as well and started kind of pushing for some gigs with that as well. So I was really fortunate to not take another job in another field when I left education, which I know a lot of people do.
Yeah.
And I think it can be dangerous to do so because, as we said, music is so all-encompassing that, you know, if you start working 30 to 40 hours a week doing something else, you need to be out there networking and getting to know musicians. You need to, you know, on the hang.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be practicing your instrument and making music with people, and you got to work hard and make the opportunities happen. And you can't do that if you're exhausted and you're spending all your time somewhere else. So I kind of made a little rule to myself that I wasn't going to get a job within the first year.
Right.
Leaving, whatever happened, I was going to find a way to get by, even if it meant that I was busking. I did a bit of busking down on the South Bank.
Oh, well.
I was like, I don't want to get a job just because I want to give music the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel that you can close off a lot of opportunities by, you know, working in Starbucks or something.
Yeah. And so your first band, that was the Phil Meadows Project.
Well, my first band was a Phil Meadows Quartet, and
right.
That was up in Manchester about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Which was with Chris Illingworth, of Go Go Penguin fame,
mm-hmm.
and a bass player called John Sandham, who's a great electric fretless player, and Finley Panther.
Yep.
He moved to Berlin, and then Rob Turner stepped in when Finn left. So that was my first band. We did a lot of gigs when I was quite young. So Manchester Jazz Festival and lots across Leeds and Wakefield Jazz Club and all of that stuff. Kind of when I was 17 and 18. I had a trio through my time in Leeds called 3.1 with a great bass player called Max Sterling and drummer called Steve Hanley. And then came down to London and set up the Phil Meadows Group, which I went to listen to lots of different people when I first came down to London. I threw myself into the scene and went to watch loads of different gigs and found that I liked four musicians who also happened to all be studying at Trinity without me knowing.
Oh, wow. That's amazing that you didn't realize.
So when we got, I mean, this is because I came to London a few months before I started at Trinity. So we got into the same room and I was like, oh, how did you guys get in through the door? And they were like, oh, well, we all study here. I was like, oh, no way. I'm just about to start studying here.
Wow, that's sick. Who are these people then?
So trumpeter Laura Judd, pianist Elliot Galvin, bassist Connor Chaplin, and drummer Corey Dick.
Yeah.
Who then later became drummer Simon Roth. So yeah, I mean, it was just great to play with people with that much imagination and creativity. And, you know, this was in the early days before any of us had done any albums or even really thought about it, you know, just to be able to take some of my music and have some new personalities on it. And I mean, the way in which all of those guys play is just so extraordinary that it was, you know, both really humbling, you know, coming down here and kind of, you know, having my ass handed to me on my own music whilst they were sight reading it. You know, it was really humbling to have that, but also really inspiring, you know, to know that those guys wanted to make some music.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I like the word imagination. That seems fitting for those guys, you know.
Yeah.
When did Engines come along?
So Engines came along a little bit after. So with the Phil Meadows group, we recorded a first album called Engines of Creation.
Right.
Which we released in 2013 on Boom Better Records. And then the idea behind Engines Orchestra actually came shortly after I finished my postgrad at Trinity, when I found myself in hospital for a week, having been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I guess it was just that idea of, I was sat in Lewisham Hospital, and it was kind of, there was this guy in a bed across from me, and I still don't know what was wrong with him to this day. But, you know, on the Sunday I was in there, his whole church came in and like held the service on the ward. And I'm not a religious person, but that sense of community kind of really struck a chord with me and the way that I was feeling at that time. And you know, and the fact that all the NHS staff were so great. We should all save the NHS. We should all campaign until we're blue in the face about that.
Yeah,
absolutely. But the NHS staff were so great and such, you know, such good morale on the ward. It was one of those things that it was like, I kind of started assessing what I was doing with my music, and like Laura and Elliot and a few other friends, in particular Harry Pope, great drummer who I play with now as well, came to see me a lot when I was in hospital. And yeah, it was that thing I was thinking, well, at the moment I'm writing music I like to write and playing music with people that I like to play and performing it on stages that I like to perform, and that's all a bit self-indulgent. And the other side of music is that it can get that way. It can, you know, you can be thinking too much about yourself and your own identity as an artist and your own vision. And yeah. I just thought, you know what, actually music is a social thing. We might spend hours practicing on our own, but it's a social thing. It's about bringing people together. It's about bringing different musicians together, you know, engaging new audiences. It's just about, you know, it's just about having a good time, and it's just about making people feel something.
Yeah.
So having been such a fan of like lots of different large ensemble music, you know, Vince Mendoza, all that stuff with the Metropole Orchestra, Maria Schneider, Kenny Wheeler, all, you know, so much great stuff. Darcy James Argue and the Secret Society. Just been such a big fan of all of that music. Made me think, well, what if I set up a large ensemble that's kind of more a community than an ensemble?
Yeah.
That are full of people who want to just bring music together and bring people together and collaborate and create and do stuff. And that's kind of how the initial Engines Orchestra idea came about.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking that it's interesting how often projects like that start in like times of hardship, or when you're kind of forced to sit and think without being able to play, you know, kind of changes your mentality slightly.
Yeah, I think it's, I'm back on fire again.
In other news.
I think it's important to stop and reassess where we're at, you know, with what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve. Because music can easily become as narcissistic as it can collaborative and, you know, yeah, engaging and community driven. You know, it's surrounded by getting press reviews and, you know, making sure people hear it and it's, you know, all of that stuff really isn't the reason we make the music, but it can often change the way we think about it. So I think it's important that we take stock of where we're at and what we're actually trying to achieve on a bigger personal, emotional scale.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the stuff that's really important.
And so this diabetes run-in that you had, how's that affected you, like, in hindsight, you know, for better or worse? Because that must have been a real, a hugely life-changing thing to go through.
Yeah, well, at the time I was relieved. Sounds strange, doesn't it? Relieved to be given a lifelong disease. But I was relieved because I'd been ill for so long, on and off.
Yeah.
And I think I'd been misdiagnosed several times. I was told that I was dyslexic. I was told that I had chronic fatigue.
Yeah.
And as soon as they finally found out that it was diabetes and I was on the mend, you know, all my vision kind of, like, it was almost like things were 3D again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, oh, that's what I've been missing out on. Because sometimes when you're ill, it can be such a gradual thing that it sneaks up on you and you don't realize, because day to day you feel the same or just slightly worse, or, you know, you can't really feel the difference. But then you know it when you feel good again.
Yeah.
So initially I was relieved to find out that I had it and that it wasn't something worse, I guess. I mean, I went to see the seventh, I've counted, and it's the seventh doctor I saw about the symptoms.
Oh, and my goodness.
And, yeah, I mean, it's just a real misunderstanding with diabetes in the UK. I mean, the NHS is great and our doctors are great, but they do need some support when it comes to understanding diabetes and its effects, particularly type 1, which is what I've got, rather than type 2.
Yeah.
Which we can talk about the differences, because often people don't realize and they think that I'm fat and abusive, which is what type 2 diabetics quite often can be.
Right.
People who have spent a lifetime eating cake and drinking beer.
Yeah.
Rather than type 1 being a disease that is inbuilt in you and it triggers for an unknown reason.
Yeah.
It's two very different things with the same name.
Yes.
But yeah, I was relieved, and then yeah, it just got me thinking. I mean, I feel healthier than I've ever felt. I'm insulin dependent. I'm now on an insulin pump.
Yeah.
So I have a little electronic device attached to me at all times
that
drip feeds me insulin, and, you know, I can put more in when I eat and stuff, and it's all very well controlled. You know, it can get you down at times, because at the end of the day, it's built into every thought that I do now.
But
so it can get on top of you. And, you know, if I want to exercise, I have to think about it. If I want to drink alcohol, I have to think about it. If I want to, you know, if I want to do anything, I have to think about it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I understand it really well. And I understand a lot about food and a lot about the way it can affect my body long term and short term. So it becomes almost like brushing your teeth, you know, something that you just do.
Yeah.
So it's only when you stop to think about it that it can kind of take over with some negativity. But, you know, it's not the worst thing that could have happened.
Yeah, I think these things all add to our, you know, the whole life experiences and the music that you want to play. They're all profoundly intertwined, as you are abundantly aware, as am I.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean about relieved. I think sometimes, like, the worst thing is to be suffering with something completely undiagnosed and just not know what it is. Like, although it's a lifelong disease, like you say, the relief of at least, like, knowing what it is and knowing what you're dealing with is better than going, like, six doctors, you know, who have misdiagnosed or misunderstood. That was an absolute, that must have been just so depressing to go through.
Yeah. Well, particularly when it takes 10 seconds to find out whether it's diabetes, all you've got to do is, you know, have your finger pricked and then test the blood sugar level. And if it's high, you've got it, because your because your pancreas isn't working.
Yeah.
It's like everybody else wouldn't have that high blood sugar because their pancreas would be working. It's a real easy thing to tell what's going on.
Yeah.
And the last doctor I saw had just transferred out of the diabetic ward at the hospital.
Right.
And he actually sent me straight to hospital and called A&E in advance.
Oh, wow.
Because it had been going on for that long. I was that close.
Yeah.
That close, you know.
Yeah.
So it was, I remember the day, it took me about 2.5 hours to get out of bed, get clothes on.
Yeah.
Because the way it works, if your body creates insulin and the insulin breaks down the sugars that you eat.
Yeah.
So any carbohydrate, and it splits it between your blood and your muscles. And your muscles need that carbohydrate to have any energy. Otherwise, they've not got any fuel. And your body needs to split it so you don't get too much in your blood, so your blood sugar levels don't go too high,
yeah.
So your blood doesn't become acidic.
Right.
And I got to the stage where I just had nothing left in my muscles, so I couldn't actually lift my legs up. I couldn't get out of bed in the morning at all,
yeah.
Because it was just nothing. My pancreas wasn't working because the insulin cells had all been killed. And my blood sugar was, you know, nearly 30, and it's supposed to be like between 4.5 and 6.
Yeah, man.
And it was that thing of I actually couldn't get out of bed, and I managed to get to the doctor just about. I don't know how I drove up the street that day,
yeah.
and then drove to hospital after.
Yeah,
it was one of those things where your body becomes kind of more powerful than you ever imagined it could be.
Yeah.
But not like an X-Man, possibly.
There were no Wolverine-style daggers appearing.
No, that was slightly disappointing. It was just me, yeah. Driving a like Toyota Aygo or something.
I remember that car. That was like a 1,000cc engine.
999.
Yes, that's the one. I remember that.
I can barely make it up a hill.
Oh, that was funny. I had a really weird conversation in that car with Hugh Morgan about a job. A job at Barking and Dagenham Music Service, which we both applied for, and I got the job, and I didn't want to say anything to him to make him feel bad, and he also was offered a job and didn't want to say anything to me, thinking I hadn't got one to feel bad. So neither of us talked about the fact that we were both going to be working together for the whole journey, and then eventually somehow we got round to it, and he was like, yeah, sorry about that. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm sorry about that. And he was like, did you get some hours? I was like, yeah. What? Oh, it was so dumb. But yeah, that all conspired when you were hosing us down the motorway. Five of us, a whole sax section with five horns in that car.
Yeah.
That
was, yeah.
Including my baritone.
I don't know how you hear your conversation over the roaring engine being torn to shreds.
Can't believe
that would have been
it.
On the way to like Lowestoft or something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was one of the, I think it was a Rat Pack show thing or something that yeah, involved.
It might have been a Jeff Hooper.
Oh, that's the one.
Yeah.
Man. Right, I've got a speed round for you here.
Okay. Not the drug.
Yeah, I've just I posted it yesterday and I'm tracking the delivery. Right, here we go. I'm just loading them up from, I've got a document from Trish Clue's interview. And as Trish did so well with them, I've gone back to the ones I asked her. Yes. So
she's going to be so much better at this than I am.
Well, her speed round was about 10 seconds. It was incredible.
Oh.
And in last place right now is Stan Saltzman. His was about 10 minutes. So feel free to answer these in any way that you choose. Who's your favourite saxophonist?
Oh, that's so hard, isn't it? There's so many. At the moment, I'm really into Donnie McCaslin.
Who's that?
So Donnie McCaslin. Donnie McCaslin is the saxophonist who collaborated with David Bowie on the Black Star album.
Oh, cool. But
he's a phenomenal American-based saxophonist, and his band has Mark Giuliano on drums and Tim LaFaber on bass and Jason Lindner on keyboards. And it's just one of those like amazing kind of like powerhouse jazz rock kind of things.
Yeah.
It's great.
Oh, sweet. What's your favourite album to listen to?
Ooh, my favourite album to listen to. These are hard, aren't they? How did Trish know all these?
She so spelt quickly? The answers out like a second after I asked them.
There's just so many great albums as well. I think my favourite album to listen to would be... which one to choose? This is so hard. I mean, I'm really into like the whole catalogue of Tigran Hamasyan.
Right.
In terms of like that sound world. But I don't know if I can pick a favourite one. But let's go with Mockroot.
Oh, lovely. What's your favourite... Who's your favourite UK musician?
Ooh, Tim Garland.
Oh, nice. What do you think you'd be doing if you weren't a musician?
Sitting in my pants and watching Jeremy Kyle.
Great. It's that time of day as well. There's probably one on now.
I know, you're interrupting my flow, man.
Well, I appreciate you taking time away for this. what's your favourite food?
My mum's homemade lasagna. Classic.
Yeah, lovely. What do you think you'd be doing? Oh, wait, I've asked you that.
Sorry. I'll give you a serious answer to that.
what's your favourite album to have played on?
Oof. I think my favourite album to have played on might actually be the Andrew Lynham Jazz Orchestra album that's not yet been released. Because the music is just brilliant and the personality is hilarious.
Oh, sweet. We'll have to look out for that. That's a news segment made in heaven. Favourite TV series?
Another tricky one. Oh, there's a lot of noises, isn't there? You could make a montage of just the noises. I think my favourite series is probably something like House of Cards.
But oh, I'm also, I love that show.
I'm also a big fan of Sons of Anarchy. Been a big fan of Dexter. I watched that over the 8 years when it was released. There's so many great shows. And I just finished watching Stranger Things, which was great.
Oh, cool. I haven't seen that.
And now I'm waiting for the check that Netflix sent me earlier in the day to cash, because I've advertised that.
Oh, yes, of course.
But yeah, there's so much that I kind of binge watch TV series. So there's quite a lot of favourites.
Yeah. And last one. If you could have a tube station connected to your house to anywhere in London, where would you want it to come out?
Oh, that's a great question.
It's my favourite one. I don't remember where I thought that up, or even if I did think that up. It's highly likely that I didn't.
I would like it to come out. Somewhere near King's Cross.
Or maybe
King's Cross. Because there's lots of things I like in King's Cross.
Yeah.
And also, you can kind of walk to anywhere from it. So it's not, it's kind of not too far from the Camden side of things, and you can walk into Soho in half an hour. So, you know, if I had Night Tube to my front door from one location, it would be King's Cross, because I think I could get everywhere that I like.
Oh, that's awesome. Nice work. Well, Phil, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, hopefully it has been.
No, it definitely has. Oh, boy. Yeah, thanks, man. Much appreciated. And we'll... I can, if you want me to send the show to you before I air it, I certainly can do. In case there's anything you want taking out or
you know.
Yeah, that might be kind of nice, but it's also horrible to listen back to yourself, isn't it?
I've done it so much now that I've stopped feeling weird about it. The sound of my own voice is strangely comforting.
Oh, you put it on to go to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. I can just fall asleep listening to myself. Yeah. That's so weird. Oh, amazing. Right, thanks, man.
Oh, no, thanks so much. That was really fun.
Sweet. I'm glad you enjoyed it. That's the name of the game.
Yeah, I hope I didn't chat too much shit.
No, it was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. All right, nice one, Phil.
Yeah, wicked. I'm going to get back to filling out a PRS form for tomorrow's deadline.
Yeah. Sounds good. Yes. Bring it on.
I love a good funding, but I hate it so much.
Oh, man. Sweet. Well, have fun. Have a good one. I'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, catch you soon. Cheers, awesome. Rob.
Cheers, Phil. Bye. Bye. That was delightful.
Lovely stuff.
That worked out great because I figured we'd do it three ways, but that was never going to work with Dan anyway.
No.
Yeah, nice.
He's
work.
He's useless.
He is. I'll let you get back to bed.
Thanks, Rob. Love you lots.
Right. So that thing with Dan didn't really work this morning because of the screaming child in the background. So I've got two phone numbers for Dan. That is really annoying. With no reasonable way to tell which one is which. Okay, let's give this a go. Voice call. Full volume. Well, this is going well.
Hey, Rob.
Aha, Dan.
How's it going?
Good. Let's have a talk.
Yeah, great.
This is perfect. So, I wanted to talk to you about the election because...
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
wow.
Heavy going.
Yeah.
We touched on it with Loz about an elected member of, like, Jazz Parliament.
Is that what they call it? The Parliament? Is it the Parliament Awards?
Oh, yeah, the Parliamentary Jazz Awards.
Yeah, the Parliamentary Jazz Awards. Maybe that's what it should... Come.
I like it. Well, what we should do here is establish three or four people that would be excellent for running the whole of the UK jazz scene. And then over the next few weeks, we're going to debate their pros and cons and whittle them down to just one and maybe have a listener vote on who it is.
Sure.
So I think we should have some nominations.
Okay, how do people nominate someone? Do they have to decide they're running, or do we just... No one's going to decide that they're running.
No, because it's jazz, so we're just going to tell them that they're in the running.
Okay.
So, I reckon that we should nominate Pete Churchill.
Pete Churchill would be a good one.
Yeah, he's very inclusive. He's a very...
Yeah. Which party would he run? What was it? Party people?
I would have thought that some kind of... Oh, I hadn't thought about parties. That's nice.
Is he right or is he left of Wayne the Jazz?
I think he's a bit on the left because he's, you know, he's got time for the little people, for music services and primary schools and all that. So,
yeah.
So he can be leftish, some kind of sort of solving the UK's problems through coming together and singing.
Yep.
Beautiful. And then.
Lovely. I like it.
We should have someone
who else have we got?
Young. Phil Meadows might actually be quite a good candidate.
Oh, Jack Davies would be a good one.
Yes! Very nice. Go. Jack already works for the Conservatives.
Okay,
perfect. Well, Jack can be some kind of... he'd be quite an extreme jazz prime minister, I think. He would...
Do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to think that he'd be quite intolerant of everything, that he'd like to have a very elitist music scene in which only incredibly good music that he considered excellent would be played.
Okay.
I'd like that. More of a dictatorship almost.
Yeah.
And quite a, maybe a communist regime.
Yeah.
And then...
Who else is on the ballot?
Hmm.
Maybe...
Pete and Jack. I mean, Norma Winston would probably make an excellent, very hard-line prime minister.
Yeah.
That would be cool. I can imagine her sort of just being an ideal immediate stand-in for Theresa May.
Yeah, she'd just come in and take over, wouldn't she?
Yeah, that would be...
Which Theresa lets her leave, yeah.
And then maybe a good...
someone... what else is there? Maybe, what's his name? I'm not going to remember his name. Edit that out. Right, take a pause from recording. I'm going to Google him. What about Barak Small?
Barak, that's awesome.
Yeah, he'd be really good.
Yeah, he would. He's very no nonsense, and but also I think he'd be good at. I think he'd be quite a leftish guy, kind of about the little people, and you know, I think he'd be quite good on the.
I'd vote for him. I'd vote for Shmuel.
Shmuel is the official choice of the Jazz podcast. I think another thing he has going for him is as a foreign relations. I would have thought he would have a good...
He's very well rhythm, you know.
Yes, this guy Barak Shmuel, he's the world rhythms expert. So yeah, an outward-looking understanding.
Martin Speak would be a good one as well, wouldn't he? He'd be very... You'd know we're in safe hands.
Martin would be an ideal guy to have in a wartime prime ministerial post, yeah. I would feel safe at war with Martin Speak in control of the country.
Okay, yeah. Gordon Campbell as well.
Oh, the trombonist, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a very politics kind of vibe, doesn't he?
I like that.
I'd imagine he'd have very good rhetoric, kind of standing on the podium delivering.
Yeah, I like it. Well, again, listeners, any strong feelings, please let us know on the Jazz Podcast Twitter, or we have a Facebook group. We have, what else have we got? I don't know, that LinkedIn that we never look at. We got some stuff. You can find us. Yeah, I did. I don't know. I was just excited. I just was doing everything. Next week is John Screet.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Right. I get internet on Monday, so I'll be back for that one.
You'll be roaring away. All right. Well, the 28th, next Friday, John Screet, you have internet. Monday, album preview show. There's a lot going on. So make sure you subscribe to the Jazz Podcast so you don't miss anything. We'll see you Friday.
Is that your Pixar impression coming out there?
That was me impersonating myself.
Oh, okay. Can you do a Nick Smart?
Yeah. We will see you this podcast. We'll f***ing see you on f***ing Friday. Now f*** off or I will f*** with you until Friday.